security. We talked ransomware, we talked nation states, but what about corporate espionage? Let's dive in on this bonus episode of The Business of Tech. So for those who don't know you, give me a little bit of a backstory of like who you are and where you got to where you're at now.
Sure. I'll do the super short version. So I actually started on, I guess what people would consider more the dark side. I was actually a corporate spy. So I was hunting for intelligence on behalf of my customers back in the late 90s. That very rapidly progressed into being a counterintelligence company where I was protecting the very same customers from people like me. They hired me to essentially figure out early school pen tests, effectively, if you want to think of it from that perspective. And that went on for a number of years, probably close to about 12. And then in 2009 and 10, I got roped into a project that resulted in me building a product company called Unveilance that I sold to Mandiant in 2012. Stayed director of intelligence for Mandiant through that period up to the FireEye acquisition. I left right before that, so may have missed out on a party there, who knows. And then re-entered the industry in 2017 with Prevalion, which actually focuses on supply chain compromise assessment. So a little bit different than what you get with the scorecard companies where they're looking at the vulnerability or the risk profile or the sort of situational awareness. We're looking at the actual compromise status of the organization. So a little more inflammatory, as we were talking about a little bit before the show started.
You led with why I wanted to have you on the show, so I appreciate that. So sure. I wanted to talk about corporate espionage. Mm-hmm. Particularly, my listeners are in the small business realm, right? Which is a pretty wide swath, right? That can be companies as big as, as 50 million oftentimes are considered small. We talk a ton about security and ransomware, but we don't talk as much about corporate espionage. Give me a little bit of an insight into the world of corporate espionage. Like, who's being targeted here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's interesting because it's changed a whole lot and not at all, actually, in the last 27 years. It's still fundamentally looking for a weak point, leveraging an individual of some kind to get intelligence that may be beneficial to the employer, whatever that may be, a government or a private organization looking to win. So competitive intelligence is sort of the watered down version and legal version of what corporate espionage essentially is. That's just more about research and trying to understand the corporate landscape to win. But corporate espionage, as it was essentially social engineering tactics to be able to collect information from usually people. When I started it, this was much more of a human to human interaction than it was cyber. Oddly enough, when I say it's changed a lot, but not at all, I'm now involved and immersed in the hunting of malware that does exactly the same thing that I would essentially do, but on a perpetual basis with no rest, no bathroom breaks. And then it harvests information and exfiltrates it out to a command and control environment, but basically still does the same thing. It tries to get in and social engineer people into clicking things or divulging information in ways they otherwise think is perfectly fine. So, and it's the underpinnings of just about everything still. Now, cyber criminal, you know, you hear about this a lot in the industry. For your listeners, they're very well aware of the fact that we'll talk about things, especially with Mandiant terms, APT groups or nation state actors versus cyber criminals. I'm here to tell you that there are sometimes a lot of overlap between the two. There's a lot of cyber militia that are cyber criminals that are hired by government initiatives or for government initiatives that the government can't do because they're just a lot more freewheeling and cavalier in their approach. And they get the job done a lot more effectively. And they do it usually for money, but in some cases they'll do it for political gain or for just purely intelligence collection. And then lastly, I'll just kind of tee off on a lot of these things. And Dave, you're welcome to dive into any of these. You look at nation state actors like Russia, China, and Iran, and there tends to be a very definitive focus that China has been primarily the focus. Their focus has been primarily on the espionage side. They're looking for intelligence. They're looking for intellectual property theft so they can benefit their country. Russia, on average, is a lot more focused on influence. They're a lot more focused on money and cyber criminal activities. Iran's kind of across the board. They tend to be a little bit more destructive. You know, they're the ones building out wiper malware and things like that just to be, you know, disruptive more than they are there in the pursuit of actual intelligence. So I kind of gave you a really broad swath of it. I'm happy to kind of dive a little deeper and wherever you think it makes sense.
Yeah. So if I think about this, you've identified kind of the cyber criminals, and I tend to think of that in that mafia group that are they're built an enterprise to extort money, generally with ransomware from organizations. And at the other end of the spectrum, we've got the nation state actors, and they're diving in for whatever nation state reasons. There's another little area that I think is alluded to, and I want to understand a little bit more about it. I'm thinking about the ones that I would think of almost like a classic spy, the kind of James Bond, but online version, where I'm diving in for particular information about that organization. You alluded to it by saying, you know, you're going in there to get competitive information. How active is that space now?
It's extremely active. It just doesn't get the headline news that the other things do, because it's not as directly tied to financial gain as clearly as the other stuff is. Ransomware is flat out money. You know, they're literally encrypting all of these systems to essentially, you know, extort people for money, essentially. But the cyber espionage or the corporate espionage side of the house is still very much alive and well. It's usually happening with far more capable professionals in a lot of ways that are able to cover their tracks a lot more. So most of it goes unnoticed unless you're looking for it. And it's usually in symphony with some sort of physical activity as well. So there's physical incursion. There's hirings of individuals over long terms of time where they get past the background checks and they're able to implant within an organization. And they work in symphony with the external actors, maybe in the other country, to harvest the information electronically or allow the access for some of these more professional corporate spy hackers to get in. So there's a lot more of instrumentation and organization there for a longer term agenda rather than a smash and grab, like sort of what ransomware is. So that's kind of why you don't hear about it as much. And unfortunately, our mass media, you know, it's too complicated to kind of tell in one 10-minute broadcast on something that happens. It's far easier to say everything got encrypted and they want $10 million in Bitcoin. And then everyone kind of gets the point. It's a soundbite. But when you start talking about corporate espionage and intellectual property, you got to get the people understanding what's being stolen. Like quantum, for example, computing. Probably people hear the word, they don't know what it means. But there's massive agendas to have that harvested and stolen. Same with AI technologies that people hear about in sci-fi comes to mind, and people don't have any idea of why someone would want that. So it's unfortunately just too complicated for the masses to generally get a hold of. That's A. And B, they're usually very sophisticated groups that are extremely well funded and organized and do this as their profession, so they don't get caught.
All right. So I gotta ask, because we talked a little bit across BMS, and I was like, so how much of the tech is real? Like how much, you know, this is all we talk about in the movies, but what's actually out there?
So the tech has changed, but it's, and I don't want to say it's less exciting than it was, but I have to tell you, the stuff that I was using in the 90s and the early 2000s was absolutely James Bond movie level stuff. For example, have you ever heard of a laser microphone before? I don't know, most people,
I've heard of it. I've never encountered one.
And it looks like a sniper rifle. Like it literally looks like, you know, where you've got a scope and you have this thing that literally fires a laser. It's not like a green laser, like the toy lasers you can play with today. It's a laser you can't see. But then you have a receiver that is right next to it that you use, kind of like what you see with guys doing surveying of streets, where they have a thing that does the sort of banking. Anyway, what I would do is I would actually sit in a hotel room, probably up to a mile away, and I could literally fire the laser at the window of a boardroom of a corporation and have that laser bounce back to the receiver. And that subtle, imperceivable vibration of the window of that boardroom, just like what my windows are doing now from my conversation, could be grabbed with that movement of the laser and turned into a WAV file. And I could scrub it for noise and I could actually get the entire conversation that was going on in that room. That would be option A. And option B, if I had the means to get in and essentially hire an asset, if you will, using kind of intelligence terminology and tradecraft terminology, is hire, you know, a local cleaner or janitor to pop in a cell phone in the drop ceiling and have it on silent with an extended battery, and then call during the time that the meeting was happening and just listen to it and record it. So there was multiple ways we do things that was, and then when we had a really, really great client that was willing to pay the bill, we get all kinds of goodies. We'd be able to get things like actual bugs that we could implant in places. They didn't look like the movie bugs where it literally looks like a little like tab, you know, those things are probably real and have been real, but at least back in the good old days, these were chunky little things that had a battery associated with them for limited time, and you had to be within range to collect the signal from them. We did a lot of war driving, cantenning, if you remember what that was from the good old days, when there were wireless networks. There were very few back then. So most of it was that for tech, but then the other side was the social engineering part, where I had a whole troop of people that worked for me that were literally professional social engineers that would meet the target at a predestined time, unbeknownst to the target. And they would get information from them. They would come back. They'd share their information with a second operative. The operative would then meet that same target serendipitously a couple of days later with all this new information they learned from the prior operative and be even more social and engaging. And then we do it a third time. And usually the third time's the charm, where that third operative was so armed with so much information from the former two operatives that when they would meet the target would be like, we're like long lost brothers or sisters or whatever, you know, and they'd share all this information and they'd win them over. Very classic government tradecraft, which, you know, they teach at the CIA and places like that, where you win an asset over time. This is where people actually do get into relationships, because they get so close to these assets. They fall in love, they have affairs, all those kinds of things happen. So, you know, the good old James Bond movies actually have some truth to them from back in the day.
So how much of that is evolved into the current versions? Like, we hear about NSO mm-hmm. group and Pegasus all the time.
Yeah.
How much of what we're seeing in corporate espionage has moved toward the modern tech versus yeah. just become another version of phishing attacks and kind of the more generic cyber stuff?
So a ton of it moved into just automation, and automation is malware. Malware is nothing more than an electronic spy that just sits there and persists in an environment and just collects information. But there are those organizations out there that just do not put stuff in electronic form, and it stays in either some sort of hard copy form or within the heads of the individuals at the helm of these organizations. And that still requires a very professional team to come on in, and they don't share stuff on phones. They're very disciplined people. So they know how to kind of avoid the risk of sharing something on a cell phone that may have Pegasus on it. So, and they're well aware of that. So they have methods of dealing. And funny enough, that low and slow or low tech strategy, which is what a lot of terrorists will use, which is the counteroffensive to big tech like satellite surveillance systems of the CIA. That is actually training that certain executives go through to stay low tech when it's an incredibly critical bit of information they're trying to, you know, protect. But that's when human-to-human interaction still wins. So it still exists today. It's just a lot more clandestine, and the subterfuge is a lot more intense. But it's a very fascinating world.
So before we move back into sort of the broader cyber, then I've got mm-hmm. to ask, like, how encouraged or worried or such are you around Apple's move with lockdown mode?
Well, you know, Apple's in a really precarious position, because every move they make either upsets someone or makes someone really happy, or both, because, you know, their whole strategy, which is, you know, privacy first, then, you know, security as well. And it's, you know, that whole dichotomy of both. Honestly, I mean, it's a powder keg. I'm again getting back into some morbid, you know, thoughts here. But for example, if I ever myself decided to get back into the game of actual intelligence gathering rather than counterintel, which is and cybersecurity, which is what I do today, man, it would be a playground out there for me right now with things like Apple and all that. They're just toys now. Everything that people employ, as much as the manufacturers like Apple and Google and all that try to impose some of these security tools that are so easy to use, that just don't use them because people are lazy, like we were talking about a little bit ago. They're just fodder for me to leverage, and people like me that actually know how to gather intel. So the pastures are greener than they ever were before for cyber and not so cyber espionage work.
So I'm going to throw out a premise and tell me how right I am on this one, or if sure. I'm completely off base. So one of the trends we've seen in this was the fact that, and you see it over on ransomware for sure, right? Mm-hmm. This is the fact that this has all become very systemized, and thus they can move faster and into much, much smaller businesses, right? The reason why SMBs are being targeted by ransomware is the fact that it is way systemized and it's easy to do now. Mm-hmm. Thus, my premise is that this is now happening. Corporate espionage is also now happening on SMBs that would long have not been the target.
Yeah.
Am I right to think this way?
Yep. I mean, you know, before supply chain attack was a term. We call it island hopping, which is a military term that we snagged, you know, typical cybersecurity industry thieving, you know, the military for good terminology, like, you know, left a boom, right a boom, all those things came from the military. But island hopping was is exactly the same thing as a supply chain attack. You're looking for a weaker operational security to an organization that you can get into and then leverage your way into the one that you're looking to get to. Or this is a part that's interestingly enough not talked about as much. You just wait for the more guarded organization to share critical intelligence with the weaker organization, and you just harvest it from the weak point. You don't always have to use it as a hot point to get in. So we all know about the SolarWinds stuff, and we talked about Kaseya. You know, those are good examples of where a organization was leveraged to then provide access to a bunch of other ones, which is interesting and very, very important and very critical. But there's an easier way, which is to simply sit and wait, because most large organizations will share critical information with smaller SMBs just through the natural course of business. And all the actor has to do is sit and wait leisurely in these smaller businesses unnoticed and grab the information when it comes in.
So what would you tell like a typical SMB, not their IT provider, but the SMB customer, about why they would have something of value? I hear the line all the time when we talk to a small business person. I don't have anything of value. What's your answer to that?
So at first glance, and I can't tell you how many times I've had this conversation too, it does seem a little bit counterintuitive that, oh, we're so small, how are we on the radar? Well, because if you have a relationship that's of interest or importance to a cyber criminal or a cyber spy, you're on that radar. Maybe not because of what you inherently have, but what you have access to or what connectivity or trusted connectivity you may have that they can leverage. So unfortunately, law firms, for example, are a good example of that, or even healthcare providers that seem smaller, but they hold incredibly critical information about much greater groups and larger entities of sorts that may be the target of these adversaries. So it's just an easier vector of access for these adversaries to get to. So you are indeed on the radar more than you might think, speaking directly to the SMBs. And it just is counterintuitive because they sort of don't think about the data they may have that's not theirs. They think about their own, which is true, that may not be as interesting to the adversary, but what they're harboring on behalf of the bigger guys is what the adversaries are on the hunt for.
So turning then to the IT provider, those MSPs that are talking to them, what are the kinds of signs that are the red flags that someone is under corporate espionage attack?
So the good old, you know, phishing tactics are still alive and well. That is a number one thing to keep an eye out for. If you see an influx of a lot more phishing campaigns coming your way, it may not be spray and pray, as we call it. It may not be people just trying to get in. They may be, or, you know, just arbitrarily firing stuff at you to see if they get in. These may be targeted attacks. Depending on the, I guess, sophistication of the IT staff of these smaller groups, if you're watching anomalous traffic in and out of your company to IPs that maybe you don't do business with, so all of a sudden you're tracking your logs, you're looking through them, you're like, why do we have part of our finance department speaking to Albania when we've never in a million years done business with them? Oh, it's a red flag. There's something maybe communicating with a command and control server there or some sort of drop point over there. Those are the things you need to be looking out for. Anything anomalous to the day-to-day interactions. And the beauty of being a smaller business is that anomalies stick out pretty quickly because you generally know what's going on with your organization. If something is really out of place, you probably have a situation you need to take a look at.
So I think I know the answers, but it's worth asking, like, well, how do you defend? And giving a little bit more than just the debate, like, is it how much people, how much tech? Like, how are you advising people, particularly these implementers, to put together the defense?
So my answer has changed a lot, Dave, over 27 years of that question. My early day answers were all these ideas and all these huge expenditures of, well, or any expenditure of just if you do this and you do that and you train and you had all these litany of things that you would do. I'm not suggesting that those aren't good things to do, but I will say that it's hard. I just want to preface now my answer is a little bit more measured and a little bit more wise, which is sometimes there's you really won't be able to spend enough money as an SMB to protect against a really, really motivated attacker that's a nation state actor that's looking to get to a partner of yours, for example. There's almost nothing you can buy or do because they'll find a way in. They have all the time and resources on their side, and they have the advantage of pounding on untrained staff within your organization that you just can't watch in a vigilant way 24/7. So I'm not trying to be fatalistic or morbid here, but I'm just telling you, after all these years, the reality is that, and this is something that Mandiant made famous, which is, it's not about when, it's about if. It's not about if, it's about when. Reverse that. That is a true statement. So really, it's more about defending is a good idea and do what you can, but prepare more for the eventuality of it being a breach where you can then triage very rapidly. Because when you identify a breach, it's what you do in those critical periods of time where there's the dwell times reduced, the lateral movement of the actor within your environment is reduced. That's what you need to think about. So I'm just sort of shifting your question from talking about defense is such a fruitless effort, though, with a smaller group. Talking about how to respond to the attack when it is successful is probably more critical.
Okay, which then leads very naturally to a question of, so I'm sure having done this conversation a whole bunch of times, what are the what are the probing questions you ask that determine how ready somebody is for the win?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I have like three good ones. The first one really is, how many times have you been able to manage a situation over the course of a given year, right? And it's funny because the vast majority of folks are like, oh, we haven't had to deal with anything, thankfully. And I'm like, oh, because you don't know about what maybe is going on that's in there. So unfortunately, my first question is usually a probing question to see just how aware they are of the nature and the pervasiveness of the issue. If the answer is, oh, we haven't had anything, thank God, we're off the radar, we haven't been touched by anything, well, no, it's, you're probably been infiltrated, but you just haven't gotten, you're not on the list. You haven't gotten to that. They're still going down the list to get to you, ultimately, is the problem. I'm not trying to sound like morbid and everyone in the world is compromised, but I kind of am. There's always something that manages to get in there. And it's about how and when it's been leveraged. The second question generally is, what kind of budgets do you have allocated? And then do you have the really difficult discussions of, do we pay the fine or do we buy the cybersecurity? Because those are the real questions that have to get answered. CEOs, CFOs, boards generally don't understand the plight of the cybersecurity professional within the company. As much as we're hoping it's growing and it's getting better, they don't. So usually the question from the C-suite is, how much is it going to cost me? And then the next logical question is, well, what happens if we don't? Is there a fine to pay? And can we get cyber insurance? And so if none of those conversations have happened yet, then you're still woefully unaware of the realities of the situation. And then the third one is generally, if they answer affirmatively to any of those questions, which is, yes, we've had a breach, but we've managed it very quickly, what resources have you had to take on and what kind of budgets are you seeing from an increased perspective over the years to get this anywhere meaningful? And if they're woefully under budgeted, well, then, these are areas where it's just a matter of time. I mean, the worst job in the world these days that people talk about, the most stressful job in the world is being a CISO. So I feel for those guys because they are under the gun of having to defend the organization. And then when defense doesn't work, triage the issue. And then when triage fares arguably okay, then they have to face the music with the C-suite of, why didn't you deal with this? Why wasn't dealt with? And all with a limited budget. So brutal, brutal conversation. And it doesn't seem to be getting any better, Dave. It's getting worse.
Yeah, no, that's my take too, is this is not getting much better. You're one of your big incidents, you were very well documented in your sort of scuffle with Anonymous, right? And that time. How have things changed in that time? Between what was happening then versus what's happening now, like what's the biggest changes you've seen since then?
Yeah, it's interesting and a very timely question because when the whole Ukrainian-Russian dust up happened and Anonymous came back into forefront and it was like, oh, look at that, they're back again. Hacktivism's interesting. I'll be the first to say that while I had my scuffle with a faction of them, Lulzsec specifically, which was more of a weaponized, obnoxious group that in many cases the greater Anonymous group didn't even endorse. They weren't happy with the actions there. I think what's gone on is people have gotten to be much more aware of some of these more crude tactics like denial of service attacks. You don't hear as much about, you hear about it, but not quite as much as you did back then. Now it's much more latent. It's a lot more subversive. It's a lot of staged malware attacks where you get something in that does reconnaissance with your environment that shares back information to send in a second dropper type of technology that then just sort of lurks and waits until it's the right time to bring in a third stage of infection that might result in finally a ransomware attack. So it's much more organized. It's much more staged. It's much more corporate, for lack of a better term, a lot less hacktivist-ish from the time that I was grappling with these guys in 2011. I mean, when you talk about like Conti Group, for example, the big ransomware group that hit Costa Rica, I think like about 3.5 weeks ago, they have help desks. They have employee benefit packages. They've got office buildings full of people running these operations. They have help desks to literally help the customer. Sorry, I said it actually Freudian slip. They actually have the victim contacted by their help desk in a very nice way, asking them how their day is, asking them, have they got their wallet open yet to pay the Bitcoin ransom? Here's how you do it. If you have trouble, we'll help you. It's literally Amex customer support. And that's how sophisticated they've gotten now since 2011.
It's funny because you've hit on exactly what I talk about on the show, where I quip that with the exception of it being illegal and immoral, these are incredibly well-run businesses. Like they have departments. They have their own HR departments. They do their own publicity. They publish financials to show the viability as a business. They run help desks. You know, it's exactly what you've done. This is somebody's job. They punch in 9 to 5 doing this work. And we, in a way, as the defenders, we oftentimes actually don't give enough respect, I think, to the other side of knowing how professional they really are. Yeah. Is that your take too?
Entirely. We are, sadly, and not to be, you know, critical of my peers, but we're woefully unaware of the fervor and like loyalty. I mean, there's all these things that go that are normally like key phrases you hear within a big corporate environment, legal corporate environment. That's all there too, with even greater motivation that the government is backing you and praising you, especially with China, for example. If they're successful, they get an immense amount of leverage and latitude within the country and power. I mean, these are hugely motivating things for these folks. Places like Russia, where you've got, you know, very, very sophisticated intelligence groups that are doing this professionally, are moonlighting as these actors that would be considered quote unquote cyber criminals, but they're really also actual government officials working on behalf of the government during their day job. And they're as motivated and focused as anyone else is in the industry. And I think the problem also, and this is a little bit dovetailing into my job, we've eaten our own dog food a lot. We've drunk our own Kool-Aid about how our cybersecurity is actually working. And we've sort of fallen for our own really brilliant marketers. And, you know, many of us have, I should say. And the reality is that I said this on another podcast not too long ago, the very first people to buy these security technologies are the adversary to break it. And so they know the way around these things before they're even delivered out to the public half the time. So unfortunately, they'll stop the low-hanging fruit guys, the skiddies out there that are trying to get into places. But you're really not prepared to take on head-to-head some of these guys purely because of the asymmetric nature of it. They can fail many times. We can only fail once.
So it does feel like, particularly here in the U.S., that the government is waking up to the need to be an active nation state more as an attacker and act as in their role as a defender. You see the moves like, you know, State Department now having its whole division of cyber, where they're thinking about diplomacy around cyber. You see CISA continues to make, you know, more and more moves where, you know, the White House has been much more active. What's your take on the motion that's going on at the kind of the governmental level? Good, bad, not enough. What's your take?
It's encouraging. It's not enough. And it's a little late. You know, unfortunately, I think the truth of the matter is that it's like a renovation. My wife and I were watching a renovation show a couple of days ago, and they kept peeling the layers back off the roof and the foundation. And there were more termites and more termites and more termites. And, you know, they got to the plumbing and the plumbing was completely eradicated. They had to change it all. And they had to go like 4 feet deep and all the way to the roof. And they when they bought the place, they're like, it's not that bad. It will just a couple coats of paint. It'll be great. And I think that's a little bit of where we were 4.5-5 years ago. And now the magnitude of the overhaul is setting in. And I think that, and I'm talking about critical infrastructure and, you know, broader, bigger concepts here that beyond just simply corporate environments that could you know, retool and get themselves fixed. But even that's a problem because you're talking about a pretty substantial amount of retooling and jettisoning of old relationships that, you know, people don't want to get rid of. And there's a lot of motivation to stay with old ways of doing things that are just outdated. We're still fighting like it's 1998, and these guys are completely light years ahead in terms of some of the capabilities. I'm not suggesting that we don't do anything right. It's just that the government is limited in what they can do. There's so much managed by private sector that unless there's truly, and you hear this a lot, but it's a true statement, unless there's exquisitely good cooperation between private and public sector, we're not going to get anywhere. That's the biggest problem we have for it right now.
So we've spent a bunch of time on a bunch of bummer stuff here. So I'm gonna ask sort of as a wrap up, like, what does give you hope in what we're doing right now as collectives? Because all the people listening are the same people next to you on the the fight, right? What gives you hope of what's going on?
So, right, you know, I mean, I'll speak for myself and some peers. There is some really good innovation and some really asymmetric ways of doing things. You know, you probably know, Dave, from looking into my business, I actually am offensive in nature. I take over the command and control infrastructure of the bad guys. I illuminate it from the outside so that they have to move. And that move costs them money. And when it costs them money, it's less profitable and they sort of stop. They eventually stop. If you hit them in the wallet, that's what will stop. And there's more and more technology like that starting to manifest rather than this defensive posturing that we talked about in the beginning. So I think that this idea of disruptive, as in maybe not offensive, because as a private sector organization, we do have to be very careful because that is in the domain of the government. We don't have the aperture to figure out what the target is. That's why with the Ukrainian mess, when the hacktivists were going in that direction, I was strongly opposed to it, because as much as it might have been in the right spirit, you don't know what you're attacking. You don't have that visibility. So unfortunately, I think now making life difficult for the adversary, not as an armadillo or a turtle, but more like a porcupine where it's painful for them to get in, and they may very well just stop because it's actually causing more damage to their infrastructure to hurt a victim than it's beneficial. That's how we can take a chunk out of this in a serious way. But we need more buy-in with that frame of mind that takes a long time to get there, to be honest, Dave. I mean, I'm 27 years in, so it's taken me a while to get here as well. But once you do get there and you realize that a purely defensive stance isn't going to cut it, now there's a good shift and a good mentality that starts to manifest that puts us a little bit more on par, and the leveling of the playing field starts to happen a little more. So I have hope there.
Well, that is a nice mindset to end on. So I really appreciate you joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSP Radio. Or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit mspradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.